This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Our lives are changing faster than in just about any period in human history. And if you will excuse the pun, that's not going to change anytime soon. Some of the biggest changes have come from the ways we create and consume the arts. While music and literature are now more available than ever, it's become almost impossible for someone to make the arts their life's work, at least if they want to keep, you know, eating.
There were ways to kind of enter into the creative class and make some kind of living, and that's what's changing.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a look at how the advances of the 21st century are pounding the creative class. We'll also spend an academic minute studying the sounds of the natural acoustic landscape. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. You've heard the expression, times are changing. Well, that's been around since we figured out what time was, and the pace of change has been jacked up to fever pitch in the past decade or so. We must constantly adjust to an evolving world, to transformation and innovation. But for many thousands of creative artists, a torrent of recent changes has made it all but impossible to earn a living. The new book, Culture Crash, The Killing of the Creative Class, looks into the roots of the crisis of the creative class in America and tells us why it matters. Scott Timberg considers the human cost as well as the unintended consequences of shuttered record stores, decimated newspapers, music piracy, and a general attitude of indifference. Scott Timberg, a former arts reporter for the Los Angeles Times, writes on music and culture and contributes to Salon and the New York Times. Over the past 6 years, he has been an award-winning freelance journalist, a blogger on West Coast culture, and an adjunct writing professor. He runs Arts Journal Culture Crash Blog and lives in L.A. He spoke about his book with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
So when did you start to notice these changes and then decide that you wanted to address them?
Well, it's funny. I mean, if you were paying attention, you could tell around 99 and 2000 that something was changing in kind of a dark and surprising way. I mean, in the 90s, when the internet came in, it was supposed to unleash this sort of alternative culture and this sort of limitless amount of creativity and independence for musicians and artists and so on. And then around 2000, we started to see what that meant. You know, you saw that musicians and record labels saw their revenues just plummeting, you know, as Napster and similar legal and illegal kinds of file sharing, piracy and so on came in. So I noticed that. It disturbed me. I love music. I have a lot of friends who are musicians. It troubled me, but I didn't really see that it had that much to do with me. It all became very tangible to me in, I lived through at the LA Times, where I worked as an arts and culture writer. I lived through 6 or 7 waves of layoffs there. And then, again, this all became really tangible to me in 2008 when I lost my job. My favorite editor, the woman who sat next to me, and it was just a bloodbath, you know, just something like 40,000 journalists lost their jobs in 2008 and the 3 years that followed. So this was a larger crisis that was brewing, you know, long before I woke up to it. The March of Inequality, which goes back to the 70s, you know, sort of the silent coup of the 1%, you know, over the rest of us. This stuff had all been taking place. I was vaguely aware of it, but it all came together for me in a really tangible way when I lost my job and then eventually had the bank, a bank that all of us bailed out with our tax money, I should add, when the bank came and took my first and only house, a little cottage where I was living with my wife and small child. So it all kind of, it's all sort of focused the mind in a pretty serious way.
I mean, as you point out in the book, certainly artists and writers and musicians have never been known to make a killing, and
right,
it's always been a tough road to hoe. But as you point out in the book, that there always was that possibility and probability that if you were diligent, you could make it and live a pretty good middle-class life. And then little by little, even given pretty good success, that was no longer attainable.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I should be clear, you know, the subject of my book is the creative class, and the subtitle is The Killing of the Creative Class. And that's a group that includes an artist, you know, it includes, say, a painter, it includes a filmmaker, it includes a cellist at the symphony, a poet, et cetera. But it also includes a dude who works at the indie record store, who used to work at, say, Tower Records. It includes a gallery owner. It includes someone who works in an architecture office. it includes a huge range of people, and this is part of what's fraying. It includes, you know, a DJ at a radio station. There used to be more niches. There was a more robust sort of ecology that allowed people to get involved in arts and culture. You know, not everybody was ever going to make their living. It's not like all the aspiring actors and aspiring musicians and so on have ever made their living in the arts. That's just not the way it works. But there were ways that the people could get involved at some level. You might not be a great novelist yourself, but you could work at a publishing house as an editor or something and be a sort of muse and be part of the process. Or, again, you could work at a video store the way Quentin Tarantino did when he sort of sharpened his sense of forgotten, obscure films. Jonathan Lethem, the novelist, worked at a bookstore in the Bay Area. Lucinda Williams, Patti Smith, others who worked at bookstores as apprenticeships. So, again, there were ways to kind of enter into the creative class and make some kind of living, and that's what's changing. It's not that art will cease to exist. It's that the connection of human beings to the arts and culture, which I think is a pretty important thing, that connection is starting to fray.
You mentioned, as we've discussed, the impact that the economy had on this, but you also talk in the book about technology. Give us a sense of how technology, pretty much at the same time, really changed the playing field.
Well, technology is a big part of this. My book is not just a, you know, the internet is bad book, but, you know, whatever the good things the internet has done, it's certainly undercut employment enormously. I mean, think of pretty much every other city and town that I know. There was a bookstore or a record store that's not there anymore. And it's partly because the economy just wiped out a lot of businesses and wiped out a lot of marriages. It's wiped out people's homes. It's had all kinds of effects. But it's not just the economy. I mean, Amazon, which for years, you know, didn't pay taxes, how is an independent bookstore in the middle of a city or a town that's paying rent and, you know, supporting a staff of often very passionate people, how is that independent bookstore or that independent record store going to compete with an online warehouse that pays people close to minimum wage and has robots putting things in boxes that go in the mail? So Amazon is just one of many examples. I mean, the way the music business has been remade, you know, we've always had record labels in between the consumer and the artist, but these days the vast amount of money spent on music does not make its way to the artist. It goes to a technology company. It goes to Spotify. It goes to Google. It goes to, you know, some sort of big corporate tech monster. And that's radically shifted the lives of musicians.
How much is on the consumer? In other words, how much are we to blame for this?
Well, I don't really think blaming the consumer makes sense. I mean, you know, again, these structures have changed and there are incentives to doing certain things. I mean, let me put it this way. When the D'Angelo record came out, we were all surprised and excited to hear it. And I was tempted to sort of order it online. But I went to a record store in Hollywood near where I live called Amoeba, and where the staff is really serious and dedicated, and where they have all kinds of jazz and classical music and experimental stuff and obscure 60s vinyl and so on. And I bought the D'Angelo record there. When the My Bloody Valentine record came out a year or two ago, I did the same thing. I made sort of a pilgrimage, you know, because these places have meant a lot to me. I would love it if more people did that, the same way that they might buy their greens at a farmer's market or might have a direct relationship to a farm, you know, a CSA, for instance, or buy a print by an artist they like. You know, so I hope consumers become more and more aware of the human toll of these shifting customs and so on. But I don't really blame people who legally download music or who order things online. You know, I wish they wouldn't, but it's not really about pointing the finger at you know, sort of arts consumers. It's more, again, a sort of technological and economic problem and shifting social norms. I mean, young people, you know, I'm 45, so I'm sort of a hinge generation where I can see the generation younger than me just doesn't pay for music. They think it's sort of absurd to even suggest it. I wish they did, and I would like it if people of all ages will sort of wake up to what's going on. I think we have a real problem until we sort of face reality about the world we're making for artists and creative people.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with Scott Timberg continues with a look at how academia can be blamed for some of these issues. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1272. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Scott Timberg, an award-winning freelance journalist, a blogger on West Coast culture, and an adjunct writing professor. He's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about his new book, Culture Crash: The Killing of the Creative Class.
You point out in the book that academia has a role in this as well.
Yeah, I'm a longtime, you know, arts and culture reporter, so I have ideas. I've been thinking about stuff for a long time, but most of what I do is ask questions. You know, that's sort of what a journalist like me does. So I try to ask the questions as honestly as I could and follow the answers and talk to people with a wide variety of points of view on things. So I ended up in a place I never expected. I mean, I was an English major in the late 80s at a school where French theory was important. I was very into the 60s avant-garde. I was sort of interested in people like Warhol and Godard and the other sort of radical thinkers of the period, you know, the French critics, Foucault and Roland Barthes and all that. I thought it was really exciting. And I guess part of me is still interested in it. But what all those people have in common, at least in part, is that they argued that in various ways, the arts, culture, literature, whatever it was not a holy thing, was not something that sprung from the soul, was not something that was enriching and morally complex and clarifying. To all the people I mentioned, and there are whole schools of academic criticism that adopted this point of view, literature and the arts are an expression of power. They're about gender relations. They are endlessly deferred signifiers, I think was Derrida's line. This stuff all sounds really technical, and you wonder, well, what does this have to do with the creative class? Well, here's the problem. When you start telling people, especially people who study literature and the arts in college, people who follow an artist like Warhol, you know, in other words, people who are natural consumers of the arts, that this stuff is all about power, that it's all a joke, that it's all political or cultural capital, then why would people care? You know, you wonder why numbers of English majors are dropping and everybody's going to Wall Street when they get out of the Ivy League schools. You know, it's partly because the cost of private colleges has skyrocketed because government support has dropped out, which, you know, appalls me as well. But it's partly because there's been a loss of faith in the sort of meaning of the arts and culture, of the sort of what used to be a priesthood, you know, which used to be a group of people who sort of evangelized for culture. Now they're not so sure.
So as we wrap up, let me ask you the obvious question of what we can do to change the course. How do we right the ship?
Yeah, well, each of these fields, you know, I write about a bunch of different fields: architecture, journalism, music, literature, et cetera, rock and roll, indie rock in specific. Each of them have their own needs and so on. So I'll just concentrate on the things that they have in common. I mean, first of all, it's, you know, I'll just repeat what I said before, that for people to understand the broad Anglo-American public, anybody who's paying attention to me and people like me, need to understand what's happening to the creative class and the culture as a whole. I mean, they need to understand that when artists and craftsmen can't make a living, we all pay the price. If people are as disturbed by that as I am, I think they'll start operating a little bit differently. And again, buying albums, supporting the book and record store in your town, buying a subscription to a publication, supporting a public radio station, whatever it is, you will miss these things when they're gone. And by that point, it'll be too late. So that's important. Another thing that's crucial to this is arts education and music education in not just fancy private schools, but in public schools. I mean, that's one of the main places and one of the most crucial places where people get turned on to these things. We need also to have, I mean, this is a big and complicated one, but it's deeply, deeply important. We need to have a robust and secure middle class. If we don't, these things aren't going to get better. And this is partly because the creative class is sort of embedded in the middle class. You know, the vast majority of artists and people who work in culture come from the middle class, and they sort of struggle for a few years, getting established and hope that they can reconnect with that group. The middle class has been under assault since at least the 70s. You know, we built a great middle class in this country starting in the 30s. It was growing. It was the envy of the world. The middle class is getting chipped away by all kinds of things, including, again, the seizing of huge amounts of capital by the 1% and the very top tier and hedge fund guys paying less in taxes than regular people. It's appalling. So if the hollowing out of the middle class continues, we're not going to solve this. But we need to reaffirm the middle class and reconnect them with the arts and culture as well. And again, this means things like public radio. It means newspapers that write about music and poetry. It means public schools. It means colleges where people actually study this stuff and pursue it in adulthood. If we don't do this, I think we're going to keep seeing these places disappear. We're going to keep seeing people dropping out of culture because they can't make a living. And we'll have a sort of just a culture of the rich. I mean, the arts will still happen, but it'll just be made and consumed by people who have trust funds. And to me, that's not a culture. That's not a world I want to live in. I want people to be able to make a living doing this stuff.
It seems to be one of those issues that when you ask people, should this be saved? Are you concerned about this? That they will invariably say yes, but actually getting them to act to do something to save it is more difficult.
Yeah, there's a lot of things. That's absolutely right. I mean, what I'm hoping is that so far, I did a big event last night, and I've met people who are sort of passionate about my argument, and they're troubled by some of the things I write about. Partly, it means people just waking up to this and taking it seriously. I mean, we have the same fight in things like, you know, global warming and climate change, or again, inequality, income inequality. I mean, these are problems people are, you know, for a long time were sort of passively against, you know, this stuff happening. Now people are starting to get galvanized and engaged. Will it keep happening? You know, I don't know, but I sure hope so. It's not going to, my book single-handedly is not going to create a movement, but there are a handful of people who are concerned about these things. And again, I'm meeting people every day who are either in these fields or know people who are. They want me to sign a book to their son or daughter who's about to graduate and go into acting or architecture or journalism or whatever. There's a nucleus of people who get it, who know what's going on. They're confused. They want to understand it. They want to make this a better world. And I hope these people will, with me, help figure this out and kind of move together, you know, move forward together in some way.
Given the primal nature of people who need to write, who need to paint, who need to create music, does that indicate that this will be cyclical, that even if we hit a low, that we're going to have an audience and a group of artists ready to go again at some point?
You know, there's some things that when you lose them, they don't come back. History is full of, you know, good and bad things, but I don't think it's necessarily fair, and it doesn't necessarily move towards justice or equity or anything like that. I don't think that, you know, the invisible hand will save us here and that we can just let things right themselves. What will happen in the medium term is hard to say, but I see no reason why the system will just simply right each other. I mean, the fact is that if you have, as we do now, a handful of huge corporations drawing the vast majority of say, musicians' income, I don't think it's inevitable that these corporations will, out of the goodness of their heart, as they get bigger and stronger, start to give more money to the musicians. Here, we'd like you to have this. You know, I don't, you know, what we have is a process of consolidation. When we've had crises like this in the past, you know, sort of the Gilded Age type crisis, we had movements. You know, Teddy Roosevelt didn't just wait for stuff to get better. The progressives and the old Gilded Age didn't just wait for stuff to improve. You know, they recognized a problem, they found ways to make it better, and they acted in forceful ways. Same with FDR and the Depression. You know, so I don't think we can just say, well, you know, somebody will figure it out or somehow this will improve. I think we've got to take it seriously and take action.
I certainly agree with that. My question, though, is more about what is at stake for the artists themselves. I mean, meaning that even if there is a crash, and with this crash, that artists are still going to create, right? That people still need to have that outlet. There will still be the material.
That's right. I mean, creativity goes back to the very beginning of the race. So no matter what happens, we will have a hobbyist culture, you know, and so there will be something, you know, people will do stuff on the side. But But the difference is, like, I'm in a little indie rock band out of my garage. You don't want nothing but people like me making music. You know, I believe in the professional musician, the professional author, et cetera. I mean, you don't get a Jimi Hendrix with somebody just doing it on the side. You know, great artistry and the kind of radical artistry that you get from a Hendrix or a John Coltrane or something is made through dedication to the craft. It's made by being alone, you know, by studying, you know, your instrument or the language you're working in or whatever. It's not something you do after a full day telemarketing. You know what I mean? So I don't want an amateur doctor. I don't want an amateur auto mechanic, an amateur journalist. I want people who are dedicated to this, who are doing it well, and who are paid to do it.
Again, the name of Scott Timberg's new book is Culture Crash, The Killing of the Creative Class. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Taking a look at another part of the world that's changing fast is what's called the Earth's acoustic landscape. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Listen closely, and you never know what you'll hear. I am Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Kim Haynes-Eitzen, a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Cornell University, is studying and analyzing acoustic soundscapes.
As we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, and as our pristine acoustic landscapes vanish at an increasingly rapid pace, it seems only appropriate to consider the rich and reciprocal relationship humans share with the landscapes they inhabit. New advances in the humanistic fields of sound studies, environmental history, and the philosophy of emotion, along with the interdisciplinary techniques and methods of bioacoustics, provide insights into ancient religious texts, ideology, and practice. My work focuses on desert monasticism in late ancient Egypt and Palestine. Take, for example, the life of Anthony, written in the 4th century by Athanasius, the bishop of Alexandria. The story presents Anthony as a hermit leaving the city to find quiet solitude in the Egyptian desert. But tensions mount as he encounters a cacophonous landscape. Demons hiss at him like snakes. They roar like lions, crash like thunder. Such acoustic encounters betray the fraught landscape of the desert itself as a terrifying place of danger, and also a landscape fit for spiritual revelation and purification. This story and the sayings and lives of other desert monks have much to tell us about the sonic environment if we listen carefully. In the darkness of the desert, sounds can be as familiar as a gentle wind or as strange as howling sands and crashing rocks. Modern ambient recordings of desert landscapes evoke the acoustic worlds of these texts, and they suggest that the lives of monks in late antiquity were intimately shaped by an experience of dynamic soundscapes. Thus, research into acoustic landscapes gives us an entirely new way of understanding ancient texts and the imaginations that inspired them, and give us yet another reason to preserve and care for wilderness soundscapes.
That was Kim Haynes-Eitzen of Cornell University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.